From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, local reactions to the deadly attack on two mosques in New Zealand.
They want you to be afraid. You should not be afraid.
We don't respond with evil. We don't respond with ugliness. That is not our way, and that never will be our way.
And we'll get analysis of some of the biggest news stories of the week from our Week in Review panel. Also today, Saturday Night Live's Chris Redd joins us to talk diversity, rap, and comedy.
I watched SNL growing up a little bit, but I was never watching it like every Saturday like some people do, because I was watching like In Living Color and stuff that had like just more black performers in it.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick, and we begin today with the shootings in New Zealand, where at least 49 people have been killed at two mosques in Christchurch, the largest city on the country's South Island. New Zealand's Prime Minister has called the tragedy a terrorist attack, and details continue to emerge, but so far police have charged one man with murder and two others are in custody. Muslims across the world are reacting to the tragedy, including those here in Greater Boston. Earlier today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh attended prayer services at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center to express his support and solidarity. Here he is speaking to those in attendance.
We pray with you. We cry with you. We support you. And we'll always continue to make sure that we do that as we move forward.
Imam Sheikh Yasser Fahmy just came from leading that worship service, and he joins us now on the line. Sheikh Yasser, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
So I know this has been a trying few hours for you here, but if you can, tell us a little bit about what your initial reaction was like when you heard the news.
Certainly, I think that it was absolute devastation. I mean, to hear and see and look at the sights and sounds that were just so traumatic and so painful. The faces that I saw online and those images are the faces that are so familiar to me and to our community and the people that we see and that we pray alongside every day. And notwithstanding the fact that many people who are close to me in terms of friends from across the country have family members who were actually killed in New Zealand.
I mentioned the New Zealand Prime Minister is calling this a terrorist attack. Can you talk a little bit about how that phrase is resonating with you?
I think it's certainly helps in the healing process and in moving in a more constructive direction to address a lot of the pain and the suffering that we see in the world today. For too long, we have shied away from using this term when identifying people who come from this particular terrorist background and orientation. And too many people have suffered from different faith traditions and different races, whether black, white, or Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, or even Sikh, who have suffered at the hands of white supremacist terrorists. And that we are starting to see that language the place where it belongs, and that is in the public airwaves for the people to understand that this is a scourge that exists, and that people, and that we as a civilization, as human beings, as people, as nations, we have to be vigilant and mindful that this exists and that this is a toxic ideology, that we have to come together and really in solidarity to address.
So today's Friday, which is basically the equivalent to the Sabbath for Muslims. Many were attending afternoon worship at the services when the attack happened. This is supposed to be obviously a safe space on a sacred day. Can you talk a little bit about what that disruption feels like and does to the community?
Well, it certainly is so painful and so traumatic and so real because of the fact that people are coming usually from work or school because we go to school, we go to work on Fridays in our countries, and then you have to kind of dip out and take a 30 to 1 hour break to pray and kind of reconnect with God in that moment. And people just kind of coming in, taking off their shoes, going into the carpeted area and praying. It's such a vulnerable and real human experience. And then to see images of people gunned down from behind like a video game, when they were in that state, when they were in the state of prostration, literally just bowing to God. And, you know, it really does make one feel profoundly vulnerable. On the same token, that coming into the sacred space and to see that people are today have come out not fearing, not cowering, but rather coming out in full force to be present, to pray and to worship and to continue to surrender to God and to pray with community members.
Yeah,
and with faith leaders and other clergy members.
You talk about that vulnerability. I want to play a little bit of tape here from Nihad Awad, the executive director of CARE, which is the Council on American Islamic Relations, from a press conference earlier this afternoon.
In the United States, we have over 3,000 mosques. So millions of people who are Muslim will be in mosques in the next couple of hours, concerned and fearful about their lives. If someone might come and hurt them, they have very legitimate fears.
And he went on to say, they want you to be afraid, don't be afraid. Have you heard reactions from folks who are coming to worship?
I think what I've come to find in our community is because of the fact that, unfortunately, trauma is so regular. Here and far and wide, because we're a very international community. We have over 60 nationalities that attend every Friday. So we're a very international community, and we have people who are suffering and experience pain from all walks of life, from all across the world. People have become all too familiar with trauma and pain. But what we are seeing is that certainly fear is real, worry is real, concern is real. People are thoughtful and concerned about security and well-being and, you know, are we safe? But on the same token, I see the strength and I see the resolve and I see the commitment that people are not going to shy away. They're not going to stop coming to these sacred spaces, not going to stop coming to the mosque, because it is a place of worship and it's a place where we come to be in communion with God and with other people from our community. And so I really do feel that our community members are worried, they're concerned, but they're strong in their resolve and their commitment to keep on going forward.
I'm wondering if you're feeling supported by the community here. We just spoke a little while ago with the imam of the mosque of the Islamic Society in Framingham, who said a group of Jewish people showed up at their worship service today to show their support. Are you feeling outreach from the community?
Absolutely. I mean, we have been showered with an outpouring of support and concern. First thing in the morning, I got a call from Mayor Walsh. I got a text message from Governor Charlie Baker, who reached out to me and wished that he could have been, and he's supporting us. And obviously, the police commissioner was with us today, and many faith leaders from all walks of life. We had two dozen faith leaders with us from every tradition. So what Boston has really shown us over the years is that we are always together. When trauma hits, regardless, it doesn't matter where that trauma may hit, we will come together and we will be stronger together and we will support one another. And that is the spirit that I hope really pervades in this moment, that we are able to collectively rise above this and show the world that there's a different way of being, that hate and anger and aggression and toxic othering does not need to inform who we are and how we are with one another. That we are human beings and we're all connected to the same source. And we need to make sure that that's what the humanity at large really begins to internalize as a spirit.
Sheikh Yasser Fahmy is the senior imam at the Islamic Society of the Boston Cultural Center. Sheikh Yasser, thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we continue to learn more about the attack in New Zealand, we want to take a look at the role of technology in publicizing these shootings. A gunman allegedly live-streamed a video of the attack on Facebook. Graphic footage that is believed to be part of the shooting could be found on Facebook and other social media sites hours after being posted, which is raising questions about the responsibility of social media sites to monitor content like this. And joining us now to talk more about that is Mason Marks. He's a research scholar at NYU's Information Law Institute and a visiting fellow at Yale's Information Society Project. Mason, thanks for taking some time to talk with us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So we know that Facebook, generally speaking, looks out for violent and graphic content, incidents like this, also suicides or people expressing suicidal thoughts. Can you talk to us first, kind of generally, how Facebook goes about identifying this content? What does it look for?
Yeah, so graphic violence is clearly against Facebook's policies, but actually detecting and preventing that graphic violence imagery from spreading is really a very large and complex technical problem. So if you think about the size of Facebook, the company has over 2.2 billion users worldwide. There are millions of messages posted per minute and billions of messages posted per day. And Facebook does have human content moderators that can review images and posts for graphic content. But there are certain limitations. There's only a limited number of human content moderators, and that's a very, very difficult job. It's been reported that it can be very traumatic for the people who do it. And partially for that reason, Facebook is using artificial intelligence to identify the content of posts and images. But there are real limitations to the effectiveness of that AI. So Facebook is training it on very large databases of billions of images from Instagram, for example. And they could theoretically train it to identify a gun or some other evidence of violence. But the problem is so large, if you think about the sheer volume of messages on the platform, and the AI just isn't really advanced enough to detect it quickly and accurately enough, that it really isn't realistic, at least right now, given the size and the state of the technology, to expect Facebook to be able to react as quickly and effectively as we might like it to.
So, as I mentioned, this footage was out there for hours. If it's not possible with the current systems, what would sites like Facebook need in order to get footage like this down sooner?
Yeah, so, I mean, part of the problem is that the Internet is set up to allow people to share information very quickly and easily. So even if Facebook was to react much more quickly than it did, people could easily download the video and stream it on other sites like YouTube and Twitter, and in fact, that's what did happen. Now, I did see some recommendations today for what Facebook might have been able to do better, and they range from potentially just shutting down the site entirely for a period of time, or potentially blocking new videos from being uploaded, and perhaps screening for certain search terms, but that could be effective. The problem there is that we might shut down the spread of legitimate news, and people do use social media like Facebook and Twitter to receive news these days. So we have to balance the effectiveness of preventing people from seeing the violence with also sharing legitimate news about the event, which is important.
Yeah, how do you see that balance? Do you think that Facebook should have more control over this kind of thing, or do you think that the risks basically outweigh the potential gain?
So I do think when it comes to preventing suicide and preventing violence and terrorism, Facebook is doing is trying to do the best that it can. And I think it should be doing something. The problem that I really have is with the degree of transparency that Facebook has surrounding its content moderation. So you mentioned detecting suicide using AI, and Facebook basically scans all user-generated content on the site for signs of what Facebook believes is suicidal thought or behavior. And then Facebook will actually send police to people's homes if the risk is thought to be very high. They actually assign a score from 0 to 1 to these pieces of content, where a score closer to 1 reflects a higher risk of suicide. And Facebook has expressed interest in using that type of technology in other areas. So conceivably, they could use it for violence, for example. They could assign a score from 0 to 1 to an image or a post reflecting the risk that that person might be a violent threat. But that concerns me a bit, because we have to question how much we want Facebook to take on the role of a law enforcement agency. And Facebook does call 911 in response to high-risk suicide posts, and it will actually help police locate users. And in many cases, police might be able to search a user's home just based on the report that Facebook has provided. So there's potential for people's civil rights to be curtailed based on information that Facebook provides. And Facebook is not very transparent. They don't have the degree of transparency that we expect from law enforcement. So if that starts branching out into other areas like preventing terrorism, preventing violence, I have a real concern that people could end up ending up perhaps with violent confrontations with police, or having their their homes searched without probable cause, just based on sort of a very non-transparent, opaque AI system that we don't really know the effectiveness of.
Yeah, Facebook's response to these types of things in the past has basically been along the lines of, we offer the platform, you know, the content is not ours, that they, as you said, they don't have the resources to monitor it. But this is a multi-billion-dollar type business. What's the responsibility there? This is obviously a video that the alleged shooter wanted out there. And Facebook obviously gave a platform for that. What's the responsibility you think that this company holds?
That's a good question. It's a very difficult question. In the U.S., at least, social media platforms are often shielded from liability by a law called the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, which treats them not so much as publishers of information. So they're generally shielded from a lot of liability. There have been discussions of changing that. I know in some other countries, there have been some groups from Israel that have filed lawsuits against Facebook for promoting terrorist messages. And it's a really difficult question. I mean, there is a balance there. If we were to make Facebook responsible for every piece of violent content, then it would effectively, you know, cease to be able to function. And so I'm not sure I have an answer for that right now, but it's something we need to be thinking about more and more.
Yeah, I think as a society, you know, you think about folks who are just maybe scrolling through their news feeds and happen to see some graphic or disturbing imagery or video. This stuff is so widely available and easily distributed. How are you thinking about that kind of availability?
I think that clearly we don't want a lot of people who might be vulnerable, like children, seeing really graphic violence on social media. But at the same time, we do have a real problem with violent content in film and music and other forms of media. And people have been trying to study the link between seeing violence on in media or in a video game and linking that to violence in the real world. And so far, there hasn't been a really, really strong scientific evidence of that connection. Some studies have come out saying there has been an increase in aggression in children, but there was just a study that came out last month out of Oxford, and they argued that there was no connection there. So though clearly I think it's important to do the best we can to prevent this type of graphic imagery from spreading, but at the same time, we don't really have clear, strong evidence that it does result in violent behavior.
Mason Marks is a research scholar at NYU's Information Law Institute and a visiting fellow at Yale's Information Society Project. Mason, thanks for the time.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll get analysis of the news, week of the news, from our Week in Review panelists. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek, and we turn now to our Week in Review. With me in studio is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Renee, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And also with us is Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Good to see you again, Tom.
You too, Chris.
So we're going to start where we just left off before the break, the terror attack in New Zealand. Shooters have left at least 49 people dead. We heard in the previous segment some local reaction. I just wanted to start with your reactions to this attack during Friday prayers to mosques in the city of Christchurch.
Well, you know, there's a lot that we don't know yet, but it does seem from what we do know that this fits into a pattern of, you know, ideological violence. In this case, it's probably right-wing white supremacist violence against a Muslim minority at prayers. Sometimes these are different ideological directions to these mass shootings, but and they're all uniquely horrible. You know, they all have their own unique horror to them. And I mean, you know, I think that in this case, in a way, one of the horrors for me is that New Zealand is such a peaceful country. I heard that the entire murder rate for the entire year is less than the number who were killed today. Wow. So, you know, I can't imagine how it must be reverberating throughout those communities and that whole country.
Oh, I just wanted to take from something Renee just said about this form of ideological violence. There's an underlying problem here. When you start to look, now, one thing we don't know is how many shooters are involved, whether this was a conspiracy. But, you know, having read the manifesto, mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty much the standard manifesto of the radicalized loser that you find around the world. And I think, you know, in the urge to kind of, we all grieve for the Muslim community, but there's an underlying problem here, which is this problem of dysfunctional young men who lash out. They kind of go shopping for an ideology, whether it's, you know, John Walker Lind leaving California to go fight in Afghanistan, John Salvi that we remember here in Boston from many years ago. You know, Dylan Roof, Micah Johnson, you can just name them. I mean, the minute I heard about this, I said, almost certainly going to be an under 35, a young male. He's going to have all kinds of grievances, disgruntlement. So I don't know how you flag and tag somebody like that, because we live in an open society. But I think there's a larger societal issue involved here about this kind of young male killer that seems to emerge with disturbing regularity.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned the manifesto, and again, we don't know that it's been, I don't think it's been confirmed that it was the same fellow, but probably it was. And, you know, that was out there in social media for some period. And, you know, we just heard a report. You had the fellow from the tech expert talking about Facebook's responsibility here, about the graphic images that were shut down. But you have to also wonder about what kind of, you know, ability these social media sites have to flag violent speech, really, on the website, and maybe, you know, alert authorities to investigate or take a look at whether this guy should. He was not on any kind of terrorist watch list, but he might have been flagged as someone with a violent ideology.
Yeah, I was reading one of the real challenges for experts in this type of scenario is that so much has become comedy material now. There's all this kind of, you know, quote unquote satire and these bad, sick jokes out there, that for experts to tell what's the difference between someone who's parroting these ideas and then someone who's actually representing a real threat, that's a real challenge for experts.
I think Renee's caution is well taken, that, you know, on the assumption that this really is his manifesto. But on the other hand, it's, you know, it's dozens of pages long. It'd be really surprising because it's not that good. I mean, one of the things that really comes across from it, like most of these manifestos left behind, is how ordinary and boring and unexceptional a person it was that left it, and that there's really nothing in it that's that interesting. So if somebody wanted to craft that, and I think that's actually, I should add, I don't represent the government, speak for the government on this stuff. But I think that's actually a flag, is that the stuff that, you know, the way you tell the difference between the satire and the other stuff is that there's almost a kind of sonorous dullness to the real stuff, to the people who are really a problem. They're not trying to be funny. They really take themselves very seriously. They believe that they are heroes in the making. And but how you flag it, what you do, that becomes, as Renee and I were talking just before we came on the air, that's a problem for civil libertarians.
Yeah, the title of this manifesto was The Great Replacement, which to me, as soon as I read that, I'm thinking of Charlottesville and the marches down the streets of Jews Will Not Replace Us. Do you see a connection to what's happening here socially and politically to this attack?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that this kind of hate knows no boundaries, really no borders, and that the internet and social media so accelerate this, you know, these kinds of hateful projects, as it accelerates everything. And also, there are no boundaries or borders to that's why it's called the World Wide Web. And so, you know, I think there's every possibility that, you know, the same forces at play here could be and have been at play here.
The connection I see is young and male.
You'd have exceptions every now and then. You know, somebody, one of these guys, turns out to be an old coot like me. You know, closer in
no
age
women,
to somebody,
no.
But almost no women, right?
Really.
Virtually no women at all involved in these. Young men who are connected via the internet, so that the social pressures that would normally tell people, look, you know, your views are completely off the charts. It's not there because they can constantly go for reaffirmation to find the one other crank who thinks like they do 10,000 miles away. And I think the other thing that unifies all of these shooters is an immense sense of narcissism and entitlement. Mm. They all construct these heroic narratives about how they're going to save. This shooter in New Zealand, a lot of the stuff he said was practically word for word that Dylann Roof said when he attacked the church in Charleston. Nobody's doing anything. We're being overrun. I have to take action. It falls to me, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they are quite alike in a lot of ways.
So there's kind of one big question that's been running through my mind all day, and I want to start. WBUR's newsroom spoke with Scott Brown, U.S. ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa, also former senator from Massachusetts, obviously. Here's what he had to say.
Whether it's our Muslim friends or our Jewish friends or our Christian friends or gay, lesbian, and straight friends or just anybody in the world. I mean, this could happen anytime, anywhere. You know, I don't condone this type of activity. It's unacceptable, and I think the key is to push back by standing tall and go up to your brothers, whether you like them or not, and your friends and people you may not know, and say, hey, you know what? You know, I appreciate you. I care for you, and I'm not going to let this affect our relationship or our status in this community.
So obviously a message there of kind of coming together in the wake of something like this. When you read through this manifesto, one of the main goals was basically to drive the two sides apart and to create kind of inflamed tensions. How do we take a tragedy like this and not let it divide us even further?
Well, you just have to have compassion for, you know, all of humankind. I mean, that sounds kind of squishy, but it's true. And, you know, the same kind of aim to divide us, you know, runs beneath all of these mass shootings that have ideologically based. And so even the marathon bombing here in Boston. So I think that as, you know, we've already started hearing the expression Kiwi strong to describe New Zealand. They call themselves the Kiwis to stay together and become unified in the face of this kind of violence.
I think one thing, and, you know, Ambassador Brown is not the, you know, most adept with words. But I think the thing he said that resonated with me is, go out and be among people. Mm-hmm. I think this is really important. We spend so much time alone. Mm-hmm. We spend so much time behind keyboards and screens that we really have come to not think of other people as human beings. I was thinking about the days right after 9/11. What I found really comforting after 9/11, I just got out of the house and I just went to places where there were a lot of people of my, you know, kind of just of every, you know, type. And it felt reassuring to me to say, you know, most people in the world are just ordinary, normal people like me. And I think, you know, spending more time around other human beings and practicing small kindnesses in real life is the right way to go here.
I love that message. So unfortunately, we're going to stick with this topic, but shift a little closer to home. Yesterday, the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in a 4-3 decision that a lawsuit challenging federally granted immunity to gun manufacturers can move forward. They ruled to reinstate this lawsuit against the gun manufacturer Remington, brought by families of victims of the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting. Here's Ian Hockley, the father of one of the victims, Dylann, age 6, speaking at a Bridgeport press conference yesterday.
I can't say I'm excited by this ruling. I wish it was never here. But what we've said from the outset is, all we want is our day in court, for the law to be upheld, and for a jury to decide our case.
So a long way to go on this, obviously, but this is the furthest along a lawsuit against a gun manufacturer has gone. What do you guys make of this case?
It's a long road to hoe, and it's kind of a novel legal theory that's at play here. You know, the plaintiffs are arguing that the Remington advertising was designed to appeal to precisely the kind of person you were speaking of, the alienated male, you know, entitled young white guy who, in the case of Newtown, Adam Lanza is a perfect example of that, and that that they're using this as a kind of violation of fair trade laws in the state of Connecticut to propose to pursue this case. So, you know, it's something that hasn't really been tried before. It's kind of almost a consumer affairs kind of consumer law, protection law. You know, so it won't be easy to prove a direct link, but I would say that one of the possible advantages of this approach is that if they do go to court, if it does go to trial, there'll be an opportunity to get a lot of material from the gun manufacturers about their advertising strategies, the, you know, how manipulative and cynical they are, and, you know, material that's really been hidden from us for a long time.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. Come to that in just a second.
Okay. I'm really uncomfortable with it because I'm not a, you know, I'm not a gun owner. I'm not a Second Amendment activist, but I, you know, it's guns are a legal product in the United States. Interestingly enough, some of the biggest gun manufacturers in America are in some of the most liberal states in America,
Massachusetts
and Connecticut, you know, which has always struck me as something of a hypocritical approach from the critics of the gun industry, because, you know, there's a simpler way to deal with this, which is if you don't want people making guns in your state, then, you know, make it hard for them to do business in your state. But I worry in general about the principle that you can take a legal product, have someone misuse it. Now, I think the critics would say the gun is designed to kill people, but the guns are designed to do a lot of things. You can certainly regulate advertising. You can talk about where it can be, where it can be shown in public, just as we've done with alcohol and cigarettes and a lot of other things out there. But, you know, where does this end? I mean, at some point, you know, was the Marlboro man responsible for giving, you know, white horse back riders cancer? Cognac being marketed to African Americans. I mean, you know, you can really go down this rabbit hole, and I'm just uncomfortable with the notion that you sort of reach all the way to the manufacturer and say a legal product used illegally makes the manufacturer liable. And I think we'd be better off regulating advertising, because I think that's well within the purview of the government. But to induce or to make a claim on actual responsibility for the and also I think Adam Lanza is probably the worst possible case they could have chosen, because clearly the kid was completely mentally ill. Probably
his mom purchased the
his
weapon,
mother purchased so. his mother thought that like stress management for him was taking him to shooting ranges. The person that is probably most responsible for turning him into a killing machine is the first person he killed. So I don't know that there's a whole lot of point in this other than kind of a general sense of social vengeance that is understandable, but I'm not sure it's the right way to go.
So you do say going after the advertisement, which is kind of what they're doing here. They're basically saying this marketing campaign is targeting a specific user. But I want to come back to you mentioned cigarettes there. Renee, you were talking about this discovery process. We talked to WBUR legal analyst, former federal judge Nancy Gertner, yesterday on the show, and she talked about the access to some of the documents that this case could bring.
Consider the tobacco litigation, for example. I mean, the tobacco litigation opened the door to troves of documents that, you know, that enabled people to look at how much what the manufacturers, the tobacco manufacturers knew and when they knew it about the danger of the substance. Nobody's ever been able to do that now because of the extraordinary breadth of the federal law and the limited nature of the exception.
So just allowing this lawsuit to proceed could eventually give access to some of those documents. How important is that, do you think?
I think it's very important. You know, I it's true that guns are a legal product, but they are not regulated by the consumer protection laws like many other legal products are. Cars can kill people. They're not intended to. But because of that, because they do have an inherent danger, they are regulated by through consumer protection. So you can't, you know, you have to put in seatbelts or whatever. And guns do not have that same scrutiny. And, you know, whether there should be a safety trigger or whatever, the consumer protection kind of efforts might manifest themselves. Guns are not subject to that. And I think that would be a great step forward if, as a result of this trial, we get there.
Well, I'm probably not supposed to undermine my own case by agreeing here, but, you know, I'll also just say, and it is true that if you're a bartender who serves a visibly drunk person, you are liable.
Right.
I imagine if the, you know, alcohol industry was buying ad space at AA meetings or something, you know, we might have a problem with that. So I think that this question of, you know, who are they marketing to, I think, you know, when I say guns are a legal product, the Constitution of the United States says they are a legal product. That doesn't mean they have to be a completely unregulated product. And I think the real argument between people of goodwill who care about public safety here is, how should these issues be regulated? How can the public be protected while our constitutional rights are protected at the same time, which is really what democracy is about.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to turn to another major news story from this week, and as always, is a Massachusetts connection. Some 50 people, including Hollywood actresses Felicity Huffman, Lori Loughlin, were charged here in Boston in connection to the largest college admission scam in American history. At a press conference earlier this week, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling said this.
These parents are a catalog of wealth and privilege. Based on the charges unsealed today, all of them knowingly conspired to help their children either cheat on the SAT or ACT and or buy their children's admission to elite schools through fraud.
And at issue here, a scheme in which wealthy parents bribed college coaches and insiders at testing centers to get their kids into some of the most elite schools in the country. On our show this week, we talked about this, and we had a caller who talked about her perspective as a mother.
It makes me feel pretty betrayed that there are two sets of rules here. As the mom on board handling homework night after night and packing backpacks and trying to send the message that if you work hard, good things will happen, it's really hard to hear that if you have the money, you can buy yourself in.
So this has been a story that's reverberating across the country. What do you guys make of it?
I've been teaching on college campuses since 1985, since I was a young teaching assistant, an assistant professor, my wife taught at Georgetown, Dartmouth, LaSalle, a bunch of other schools. This really... This one really makes me want the federal government to drop the angry hammer of Thor's vengeance, because it's more than, you know, I think there are folks who are looking at this and saying, well, you know, rich parents are just spreading some money around. That's not what's going on here. This is an attack on the system itself, on credibility and faith in the system that from, you know, you're going to, when this story gets enough exposure, and it will, you're going to have a lot of people saying, so the SAT doesn't matter, achievement mm-hmm. tests don't matter, application packages, essays, athletics, nothing matters. Because if you can find somebody where you can, and the amount of money is eye-watering. You know, one of the things that struck me here is, if I couldn't, and I don't want to ding any school, I'll say right now, my Massachusetts connection, we're sitting here at BUR. I am a graduate of Boston University.
Me too.
And a loyal alumnus, and feel that this is one of the best things that ever happened to me, was going to Boston University.
And that BU connection is not why we invited you on the show. I just cleared
that. Renee and I didn't know that until 2 seconds ago. But, you know, if you're going to spend, you know, $500,000 to get your kid to USC,
Much money.
You know, give them the $500,000 and set them up in a business, or let them. To me, this is rich parents spending money so their egos feel better about what their children are doing, and in rigging this, because the most chilling part to me was the guy who said, "Oh, it's been working for 25 years." Mm. That's terrifying, and I think it just really undermines faith in. An educational system that I think a lot of people already have some pretty shaky feelings about to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so it's not news that the wealthy and connected and privileged parents have, you know, an advantage when it comes to getting their kids into elite schools. I mean, I almost spit out my coffee when I was reading Andrew the U.S. Attorney Lelling say, you know, solemnly.
It's not like they bought a building, right?
Well, no, he said, there can be no separate college admission system for the wealthy.
Yeah.
Well, of course there is a separate system for the wealthy. I mean, of course there is one. What's galling here is the blatant fraud and cheating that gets behind it. I mean, you know, there are ways to, whether you're a legacy or you send your kid to private school because you have the money and they have better guidance counselors because of it and they get to take test prep. You know, this is all something that is so-called rigged for the wealthy to start with. But, you know,
do you see a difference between the legal and illegal of that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I think it's a continuum, let's say that. And I think it's also, you know, Tom mentioned the eye-watering sums that are involved here. I think it's also a symptom of the increasing concentration of wealth that we have in this country at the top. I mean, if parents are barely blinking at spending $500,000 to bribe a, you know, soccer coach or whatever it was, tennis coach, to get their kids into college. Wow.
I mean, 6.5 million in one case.
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, normally people who follow me on Twitter and argue with me, you know that I don't really, I'm not particularly moved by arguments about income inequality, right? And income distribution. This is one place where I have to backtrack from those arguments and say, this is like Russian levels of corruption. This is like Moscow level of corruption where, you know, you have ordinary people, you know, driving trucks and working in restaurants. And then you have a guy who says, okay, I'm going to give you $1 million to take the SAT for my kid. And I should add, I don't think it's I totally understand universities. If someone walked up to Harvard or MIT or BU and said, listen, I'll build you a particle collider if you take my kid. I don't judge a school for doing, as long as you know that, I mean, there's at some point the standards can't get too low, but I suppose, you know, for a college to say, well, we probably wouldn't have admitted your son, but since you're going to build us a particle collider, I think we can probably have a discussion about that. That's different than saying we're going to set up a massive infrastructure across the United States to undermine every possible indicator of merit, including standardized exams. That is the one place where, you know, everybody, having gone through all this for years myself as a student and as a teacher, the SAT is like the one place you're really alone, right? I mean, you can have all the test prep in the world, you can have great coaches, but in the end, they shut the door and they point at the clock and you have to go. The idea that you can pay people to do this or get the answers, I mean, it really is hitting the system in its most vulnerable point. And I hope everybody involved pays, well, I was going to say pays a high price. They've already paid a high price, but I hope they pay an even higher price.
Yeah, go ahead. I just want to say that we have to take one half a second here to think about the message it sends to the kids, to the students. I mean, either that their parents are saying, we don't think you're good enough without us, you know, putting our huge thumb on the scale.
Yeah, a lot of these kids involved didn't even know this was happening.
Right. Or
it's got to be devastating.
Right.
Yeah.
Or that somehow, you know, you're not worthy if you don't go to an elite college. I mean, these are messages that we're sending to our youth that are really unhealthy, really toxic, and we need to think about that, too.
Or not even an elite college. I mean, there's a...
Right,
you know,
USC.
I mean, you know, it's not just buying your way into Stanford. It's buying your way into, you know, the next tier, which that was the part that I found even more shocking, because in some cases they were laying out money that was more than the entire full boat tuition, you know, for the school.
We've heard a lot too from students of color saying, I've had to deal with all these questions about, do I really belong here? Am I just a case of affirmative action? And this really is just so frustrating to have fought so hard to get here.
I taught in an Ivy League school, and kids that were athletes, kids that were children of color, or legacies of previous students all had to take that criticism, and this is just going to make it a lot worse.
Yeah, that's Tom Nichols, professor of national security affairs at U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and the Harvard Extension School. Tom, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. And Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Renee, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. If you watch Saturday Night Live, you might recognize our next guest as the face and the voice of Kanye West.
First, let me begin with the idea that time is a myth of infinite amounts of universe, and I'm a prisoner in a different dimension. Have I lost anyone so far?
That's artist, comedian, and self-proclaimed failed rapper Chris Redd. Redd is the 19th African-American cast member to appear on Saturday Night Live in the show's 44 seasons, and he's headed to Boston to perform stand-up at WBUR's City Space on Saturday. We caught up with Redd earlier, and he talked about how it feels to be in his second season on SNL.
The second year is awesome because you're not thinking about getting fired all the time, because it's not that new of an environment anymore. It's constantly changing, which is fun and also challenging at times too. But at the same time, to know the ropes a little bit just definitely gives you a little bit more comfort.
Did you watch SNL growing up? Did you have kind of comedians or sketches that you really kind of connected to?
I watched SNL growing up a little bit. Like, I would watch it for Eddie and Chris and Tracy Morgan, and then I tuned back in again around the Will Ferrell, Tina Fey years. But I was never watching it, like, every Saturday like some people do. Because I was watching, like, In Living Color and stuff that had, like, just more black performers in it. But I always loved SNL. I always loved, like, everything Eddie did was like, oh man, if I could be on that show, I want to have an impact like that. And I think that's what every black sketch performer feels like. And it really motivated me to want to, like, leave something behind that people can look at even half as much as they do Eddie. That would be cool, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned SNL is a pretty historically white show. I think you're the 19th African-American cast member in 44 seasons. I mean, how do you think about that? It does seem like the show has shifted a bit in terms of trying to be more inclusive. But do you think about kind of the history and your place and your voice on that stage?
Yeah, being a black person in general is hard not to think about history of anything. It just kind of comes with it. But, right now, there's definitely more black people working there from writers to cast members at one time than there's ever been. And I think it's a good step forward. I know the show has gotten flack for it in the past, but I think they're making a good effort by bringing us in there. I was going to say something else, but I forgot this is radio, so I'm not going to say that.
You mentioned Tina Fey earlier. I know she, like so many comedy greats, got her start at Second City. That's also kind of how you got into comedy. When you got into at Second City and started touring the country with Second City, did you think about some of the folks who've been there, or I know it was a second career for you. Was it just kind of, here I am, this is where I happen to be doing comedy right now?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a second career, and it definitely is if you like know numbers. But for me, it feels like something I was always supposed to do. I just never really took advantage of it or saw it in the way, because I was trying so hard to be something else. And it ended up that rap was a part of my utility belt that was going to make me just, like, better at this in my own right. And I think about those people that came before me, but at the end of the day, I just wanted to find my own voice in it, because there's only been so many voices before me. So, and I knew that at least when I saw kids coming to the shows and they were leaving, like, wanting to do this, or, like, I was on the South Side teaching at Tilden High School, and I saw kids from that program, like, going through the program at Second City. That's when I was like, oh, man, this impacts way more people than I thought it would, and I just want to continue to do that, because it's a special thing to be able to perform and to touch people and inspire people. So, like, if I could do that with a dumb joke, that's cool. You know what I mean?
All right. Well, speaking of a dumb joke, you mentioned earlier that SNL is always trying to kind of evolve and change the its approach. So I just want to play a little tape here and ask you about trees.
Hey, excuse me, Mr. Bro, sir. You have time to talk about the environment?
Trees?
Climate change?
Oh, no.
What you mean, no?
I just don't believe in that garbage.
Yo, bag this fool, man. Get the car.
Get him. Get him. Get him.
Trees. I be loving these trees.
Loving these trees.
Trees.
Woo, woo. I be loving these trees.
Loving these trees. Make that seed work right in that dirt. Make you a tree. I planted all of these trees. That's a whole lot of oxygen.
Y'all know me. Puffing that OG. Young VIP.
So I'm curious. The digital short is this new way that, gets all these shares on Facebook and Twitter and kind of flies across social media. A lot of them go viral. Is that something that you guys think about when you're writing, is, hey, this is going to be great for sharing and kind of spreading? Or is it more just what's funny is funny and regardless of what format it takes?
That's something like we found later. Like, I don't think anybody who's a true artist is like, dude, this is shareable content. You know what I mean? Like, that, I feel like that's right. A weird way to do it. But I think that
That's been a big part of the resurgence of the show, is that these are things that people kind of see the next day, even if they don't catch the show live,
which is super dope. And I love that. I've always been envious of the Instagram guys and girls who can, like, make these videos and capture their ideas and share them. And I wish I was just better at the internet so I could, like, do that myself. But I've also never really wanted to do it in that way. My version of that was to be on a sketch show where I could take what Lonely Island created, because I mean, I always looked at the show. That's outside of like everything I've named before. Lonely Island was like the people that I looked at, like, yo, they're doing something dope that I want to do with my music. You know what I mean? And they just laid the groundwork for something so cool. And I knew that when I came to SNL, when I got the call, I was like, one of the things I want to do is I want to make videos. I want to make rap videos. I want to make all kinds of videos. Like, it was just like an important stamp to me. Like, when I leave this building, they gonna know me for some videos. You know?
There you go. All right, so you've got a stand-up show coming up Saturday in Boston at WBUR City Space. Can you give us a little glimpse what you're bringing to the stage here?
Man, listen to my album, But Here We Are, and that will set you up for what I'm about to talk about, because I'm not doing the same material at all. I've been doing a bunch of new material, but it's going to be about my family. It's going to be about my dumb thoughts I have. It's going to be stand-up, man. I'm not going to be doing a Q&A. I'm not going to be doing any of that garbage, man. I'm coming here to tell jokes.
Hey, garbage, come on, man.
I'm not saying not garbage. I say garbage all the time. I don't mean garbage.
That's
all right. Q&As aren't garbage. Questions and answers are beautiful. I'm just saying that I'm coming to do some stand up for real, so it's going to be fun.
Great save. All right, I wish we had
a great save.
I wish we had more time. That's Chris Redd, comedian, actor, SNL cast member. Chris, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us.
No problem, man. Thanks for having me.
You can find tickets to see Chris Redd perform live this Saturday night at WBUR City Space at radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.